From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With Saddam Hussein's army in ruins, there perhaps hasn't been a better time in decades for a democracy movement in Iraq. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine that possibility with Laith Kuba, an Iraqi dissident living in exile in London, where he heads a group of exiles called the Democratic Reform Movement. Does Saddam Hussein's stunning military defeat also spell defeat for Yasser Arafat and the PLO? We ask Rashid Khalidi, the assistant director of the Center for Mideast Studies at the University of Chicago. We review the military lessons of the war with military historian Sir Michael Howard. And rock critic Ken Tucker checks out three British bands that are setting post-Thatcher alienation to a beat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Poor reports from Saudi Arabia say that the discussions of a permanent ceasefire that were planned for tomorrow have been put off for 24 hours. Members of the UN Security Council have been meeting privately to discuss an American plan for ending the war. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
According to a U.S. official, the Council's first post-war resolution is not a ceasefire measure, but sets conditions for officially ending hostilities. Only if a series of conditions is met will there be formal ceasefire, and it reserves the right to resume the war if Iraq fails to comply. Many conditions have already been accepted, including an agreement that military commanders meet with coalition counterparts, and Baghdad has also agreed to the 12 UN resolutions passed against it. However, new measures include immediate release of all POWs and Kuwaiti detainees, along with the remains of any who have died in captivity. All Kuwaiti property must also be returned immediately. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The Iraqi government kept up a defiant front on Baghdad radio today. Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz charged that the U.S. had committed so-called provocations during the suspension of fighting, and he demanded that all foreign forces leave Iraq immediately. Aziz claimed that American warplanes were making provocative flights over a city about 175 miles south of Baghdad. U.S. military officials confirmed that they are still making reconnaissance flights. Aziz also charged that Allied forces were still moving troops into southern Iraq. Allied commanders say they're now occupying about a sixth of Iraq's territory. The commander of Kuwait's army in exile said today that law and order is being reestablished in Kuwait City. General Shir Ali Sabah said that many of the resistance members now patrolling the streets were members of the country's pre-invasion army and police forces. NPR's Deborah Amos is in Kuwait City and reports on the efforts to return the war-torn city to stability.
Kuwaiti special forces are taking up positions in their liberated city, the first step towards law and order here following the exit of Iraqi troops. Today, shots were traded between these American-trained Kuwaiti units and Iraqi intelligence officers hiding in a residential neighborhood. Yesterday, a Kuwaiti opposition figure was shot at his home. There's no information on the culprit. Kuwait is now under martial law for the next 3 months as the Kuwaiti government in exile seeks to reestablish control here. Kuwaiti resistance members are already asking questions about how the ruling Sabah family intends to govern. Those who spent 7 months under Iraqi occupation are demanding a say in the new government. In Kuwait City, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 28 points to close at 2,909. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR. Military officials in Saudi Arabia say they've had reports of anti-government demonstrations in Iraq. Marine Brigadier General Richard Neal told reporters that there have been reports of demonstrations in two towns outside Baghdad. Neal said the demonstrations appeared to reflect disenchantment with the war and said unrest is expected to grow when Iraqi casualty figures become public knowledge in Iraq. Most Allied officials have refused to estimate the number of Iraqi casualties in the Gulf War, but some say the number is massive. The American Civil Liberties Union in New York has filed suit against Pan Am, charging the airline with discrimination and harassment against Arab Americans. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports from New York.
The American Civil Liberties Union says although Pan Am has officially rescinded a policy which barred Iraqi nationals from Pan Am flights, they say there's still an unofficial policy which discriminates against Arab Americans. Lucas Gutentag is a lawyer with the ACLU.
Our complaint documents numerous cases where people of Arab descent have been forced to show a passport in order to travel on a domestic flight, have been interrogated and harassed at length at ticket counters simply because they are of Arab origin.
The two plaintiffs in the suit are the American Arab Anti-Discrimination League, which claims it has received numerous complaints against Pan Am, and an American citizen of Iranian descent who was forcibly removed from a Miami flight, held and interrogated by Pan Am security agents. Pan Am Airlines said it had no comment on the lawsuit. This is Maria Hinojosa reporting.
Another one of Colombia's rebel groups laid down its arms today in exchange for a government amnesty and a promise of political rights. The People's Liberation Army was said to be the biggest rebel group so far to reach an accommodation with the government. The group's been fighting the government for 24 years. By laying down its arms, the People's Liberation Army automatically obtained 2 voting seats on the assembly that's been called to rewrite Colombia's constitution. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The French newspaper Le Monde reported earlier today that Saddam Hussein has been seeking asylum in Algeria. The Algerian foreign ministry denied it, but it's gotten people speculating on something Laith Kuba thinks about all the time. What will life be like in a post-Saddam Iraq? Laith Kuba is an Iraqi dissident living in London. He's the founder of the Democratic Reform Movement, a pressure group of exiles who hope to move Iraq toward democracy. Kuba moved to London in 1976 to study for a Ph.D. in civil engineering. After Saddam Hussein became president of Iraq, Kuba decided to stay in London and become an activist. We caught up with Laith Kuba in Boston, where he's attending a conference on ethics at Tufts University. I asked him how he felt when he first heard about the ceasefire.
I was very relieved, and I think the majority of Iraqis are very relieved that the fighting has stopped. We've been arguing for quite some time that this is not the best way to achieve the objectives. It might create more problems. And I think we're all relieved that so many Iraqi soldiers have actually escaped death and surrendered, as we expected them to do. And the general feeling amongst us is basically we're relieved.
The coalition forces achieved what's being called a brilliant military victory. What do you think of the strategy of having bombed Iraq as much as the coalition forces did?
Regrettably, we don't think it was a good thing for the country. It's not good thing for the U.S. future, U.S.-Iraq relationship. It's not good for the U.S. position in the region. We don't believe it was necessary at all. The people have suffered most, and anybody who knows a little bit about Iraq would realize that it is not the people who supported Saddam Hussein or brought him to power. And hence, by bombing them, you've just created animosity between the United States and the people of Iraq. And if the people had always looked at Saddam Hussein as the only enemy and hoped one day that other countries would come to their rescue, what they saw is that other country came and bombed them instead.
If Saddam Hussein is removed from power and replaced by somebody else, what are your concerns? Do you think that will necessarily quickly change the country?
Well, we'll welcome any attempt or any move to remove Saddam Hussein. I think he has become very much a symbol of evil. But I think it'll be a disaster to think that he is really the evil and that by removing him, everything is going to be nice and rosy. It's not. We believe there are fundamental issues that need to be addressed. We welcome removing Saddam Hussein. We will welcome removing his clan, who are running the security apparatus in the country. We will welcome seeing the army going back to barracks and not interfering in Iraqi politics. We will welcome freedom of political expression. We will welcome that all Iraqis in exile go back to the country and contribute and encourage to rebuild their country. So I think we would like to see more than the removal of Saddam Hussein. We will welcome the aid Iraq will get from other countries, but we will not welcome the regional interference or the Western interference in Iraqi affairs.
Now, you've been very outspoken in exile against Saddam Hussein. I know that a lot of Iraqi dissidents are afraid to speak out. It must be very difficult to keep a movement like yours going when people can't really talk because they're afraid that their family and friends who remain in Iraq will be punished.
Saddam has ruled in the past decade or more by one weapon, which is fear. Now, fear turned out to be a very effective weapon. Don't forget, he extended that fear even here in the West. He gave the impression to the whole world that he has so much under his disposal that there'll be endless bags of coffins coming to the United States if he's attacked. What turned out to be is that he effectively uses that weapon, fear, to deter people. And he did succeed. He actually terrified Iraqis through torture and terror and really made them prisoners of that fear. We are fully aware of it, and hence we know that Iraqis might not be outspoken and might not participate effectively because of that fear. We as a group can only surface where Iraqis can find freedom of expression. So long as fear dominates Iraq, we cannot become a popular movement in Iraq. But, however, we believe that those days are over. Many, many Iraqis now feel that the country needs them, and hence they must participate one way or the other. And I, myself, I'm not a prisoner of that fear. I am cautious, but I'm not a prisoner of that fear, and I'd like Iraqis to come out of their shells and out of their skeletons, to come out and speak about their needs, how they perceive the country, and participate positively. We need that transformation amongst Iraqis in order to be positive about the future.
You're trying to create a democracy in a country where it's not safe to speak your mind. And I think it would be very difficult to get to the point to have a majority rule government there. Do you think that perhaps the only way to get it to the initial stages would be to have another country help impose a different leadership, a more democratic leadership?
I think there are enough forces now within Iraq. There are the forces of the state, which we do not consider as an enemy. We consider the leadership and the security apparatus as an enemy, but I think forces within the state, you're talking about the army and the Ba'ath Party and the actual administration. Yes, they were wrong. They were under wrong leadership and under wrong policies, but they are part of Iraq. We recognize that fact. We recognize as well that different communities in Iraq has expressed themselves through different political groups. And we read that as well. What Iraq needs now is political management. I think assignment one is, yes, we do need help of other countries to ensure political management of all these forces towards political reform. I think democracy can only come at a later stage. If we don't manage the country now, if we don't manage all these issues and all these forces that are hitting Iraq, yes, Iraq might be polarized. It can be exposed to regional influence, and the whole experiment might fail very badly. In order to stop that from happening, we believe in encouraging others to assist Iraqis in managing their affairs and creating a consensus amongst their communities.
Can you tell us how you reacted to seeing Iraqi soldiers kissing the coalition forces as the Iraqis were taken POWs?
Yes. Well, I can tell you not only my reaction. I was in London, and I think one Kuwaiti who was on television, he nearly cried when he saw that. He cried, A, because of the humiliation that Saddam Hussein brought to Arabs and Muslims, and B, cried in sorrow for that pathetic soul inside that body that has been humiliated and defeated to such extent. I think what people have seen and what we saw in those thousands of Iraqis surrendering in such a humiliating way is how much Saddam has crushed the personalities of Iraqis inside Iraq. And of course, it saddens us deeply to see that those poor souls have been crushed and humiliated to that extent. Perhaps it'll explain to the world when they see people chanting and kissing the hand of Saddam Hussein, why they do it. Once they see that Iraqi soldier kissing the hands or the boots of an American, they understand why they do it. Those people have been absolutely ruined inside. And you can imagine that his brother or his father or his sister have been killed or raped or whatever inside Iraq. And this guy has lived under constant fear in the last 10 years. He knows that the sun, there is a sunrise and there is a sunset and there is Saddam Hussein with his terror. It has become one of the permanent features of Iraq. And obviously those people have been crushed. The thing is, we believe Iraqis in exile can contribute partly because they've not been exposed to such humiliation and they still have kept their Iraqi identity intact to participate. And hence we do believe that, I think I've mentioned this earlier, we believe that a transformation amongst Iraqis is needed to get them to regain their confidence, get them back in active participation in Iraqi life, in administration, and in politics. And this is not going to be easy.
Laith Kuba is the founder of the Democratic Reform Movement, a pro-democracy group of Iraqi exiles. Kuba lives in London. Coming up, where does the end of the war leave the Palestinians? First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. The PLO sided with the war's big loser, Saddam Hussein. Yasser Arafat hoped the war's resolution would be linked to settling the Arab-Israeli conflict. It was one of Saddam Hussein's conditions, but one of the first that he dropped. At the beginning of the war, we asked Rashid Khalidi for his analysis of why Arafat aligned himself with Iraq. We called Khalidi back earlier today to see where he thinks the end of the war leaves the Palestinians. Khalidi is the associate director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago.
I think that in many ways the Palestinians are losers. They're losers at least in two concrete senses. In the occupied territories, they have suffered imprisonment. The whole population, 1.8, 1.9 million people, have been imprisoned since the middle of January. Moreover, in Kuwait and in the Gulf, since the crisis began in August, there's been a terrible economic effect on Palestinians, of the disasters that have been inflicted on Kuwait itself, and of the very severe impact of this whole crisis on the various economies of the Gulf and of Jordan. So that in simply material terms, Palestinians have been among the biggest losers, not perhaps as big as the Kuwaitis, but in terms of the importance of Kuwait and of Gulf remittances to the Palestinians in the occupied territories in Jordan, certainly very enormous losses have been incurred.
Do you think that the PLO made a big mistake in siding with Saddam Hussein?
Well, the problem with the PLO is that it's not a jackboot military dictatorship which can tell its people what to do. Part of the problem with the PLO is that they're politicians who are in some measure dependent on and responsive to public opinion. And Palestinian public opinion was fervently anti-American since way back the beginning of 1990. As a result of America's rejection of the Palestinian Peace Initiative, as a result of the United States failing to respond to what the Palestinians felt was a major move on their part towards a settlement. Since that time, and especially since the Bush administration's breaking of the dialogue with the PLO, the strength of Palestinian feeling against the United States has been very, very great. And frustration with the situation, frustration with the Arab regimes which are allied with the United States and which failed to push the Palestine cause has been so great that it was no surprise that public opinion was supportive of Iraq and of its standing up to the United States. The problem, of course, is that Palestinian leadership which followed public opinion in some cases did so knowing the dangers of what they were doing. They don't have prisons and the secret police and the ability to manipulate opinion like some Arab governments do, and they don't have this kind of incredible control over the media that you often have in more democratic countries as a means of managing and manufacturing consent. So, to some extent, they were prisoners of a public opinion that was very blindly supportive of Iraq, and to some extent, I think still is.
But don't you think that the leadership of a movement should have more moral fiber than to align itself with someone who's clearly a tyrant who suppresses the human rights of his own people?
Well, I mean, it's not like they have a whole hell of a lot of choice. I mean, it's not as if Hafez al-Assad and King Fahd of Saudi Arabia are these great Democrats who who are enlightened bearers of Jeffersonian principle. I mean, we're talking about jackboot military dictatorships on either side. We're talking about dictatorial autocracies and feudal, backwards feudal regimes on either side. The Palestinians have very little choice with whom they align themselves in the Middle East in those terms. They were, in fact, aligned with Algeria, Tunisia, Jordan, and Yemen, which are the only countries in the Middle East that are moving towards democracy. So, I mean, those are not the terms that the thing has to be put. Saddam is not just a nasty, was not or is not just a nasty dictator in terms in domestic terms. He's not just somebody who invaded a defenseless country. He's also a leader who's never been terribly friendly to the Palestinian cause, in the past at least, until the last couple of years. The problem with the Palestinians is that all Arab regimes fit those, one way or another, fit those descriptions. They have to choose between a variety of unfriendly and unattractive actors with whom to align themselves. And I think that when you talk about leaders of a movement showing moral fiber, what we have to remember is, like Israeli leaders and American leaders and Egyptian leaders and everybody else, in the first and last instance, leaders are politicians. I mean, I'd like to say that our president shows moral fiber, but one often feels that, like every other politician, the first thing he looks at is the polls and what he thinks will sell and what can be sold. And that's, I mean, to be fair, that's normal for politicians. And these guys, to their credit or discredit, behaved like politicians. You can talk about moral fiber, but at least put it in that kind of context.
I think the PLO started with Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein was the person who was seemingly standing up for Palestinian rights and trying to link the Palestinian cause to a resolution of the war. And, he dropped that a couple of weeks ago.
He sure did.
And now Saddam Hussein is sunk. I think everybody feels that the PLO has really lost credibility.
Well, I think that what you're saying, all of that is obvious. The PLO thought, the Palestinians thought that Saddam Hussein was going to do something for them. The Palestinians were wrong. The leadership knew better in most cases, but probably felt they had no choice. Remember, the alternative is to stand with the United States, which is your enemy and is the supporter of your enemy and which has shown itself to be hostile, unfriendly, and denies your national rights as it destroys an Arab country. In Arab political terms, this is not going to go down as the liberation of Kuwait. The liberation of Kuwait is one of the things that happened in the course of the destruction of the most developed Arab country at a cost of hundreds of thousands, perhaps maybe 100,000 or more lives, at the cost of $200 billion of infrastructure destroyed. And that's what most people in the Arab world are going to think of this. For the PLO to stand with the United States in those circumstances would have been impossible. Whatever has happened to the PLO, the Palestinian cause, the issue, which is at the root of this all, I would argue, is exactly where it was before. I mean, there is a question of occupation. There is a question of national self-determination. There's a question of peoplehood here. And I don't think you would say that because the representatives of Israel's cause are bad or good or whatever, that the issue of Israel or Israel's existence should necessarily go down in our priority list. That's what's happening with the Palestinians. Because of the criticism of the PLO leadership, people are taking that as an excuse to ignore the issue of occupation. I mean, what's happening in the occupied territories is barbarous, and it continues, and it will continue, and there has to be some means of addressing that and of resolving the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, however smart or unsmart the Palestinian leadership is. I mean, you could make similar arguments about the Israeli leadership being smart or unsmart, but you have to deal with the Israelis and whoever their leadership is. You have to deal with whichever parties there are in the region and whatever their leadership is. And I'm afraid that sooner or later we're going to have to come around to that. There's a lot of grief probably between now and then.
Do you think the PLO is going to remain the Palestinians' bargaining agent of choice, or do you think that there's going to be another group that will replace the PLO because of the way the PLO aligned itself with Saddam Hussein?
Well, there may be changes inside the PLO, or there may be changes inside in Palestinian politics, but what you can expect or attempt to impose clients, agents, people who are subservient to external actors, whether Arab or Israeli, as puppet representatives of the Palestinians. I don't think these will have any more success than similar attempts have had in the past. That doesn't mean that the Palestinians themselves may not, in time, decide on changing things. But I don't think that the internal process of change among the Palestinians is going to be facilitated by the unanimous chorus of other people electing representatives for the Palestinians. The United States and Israel's solicitude for the Palestinian people is not exactly notable, and all of the noise coming out of the United States and Israel about how discredited the Palestinian leadership is probably not going to facilitate a process whereby the Palestinians make whatever changes they feel are necessary.
Secretary of State James Baker is going to the Middle East next week. He'll be meeting with the Israeli government. What role do you think the United States is going to play in the Arab-Israeli conflict in the near future?
I don't know. I would hope that the United States would play a more active role than it has played in the past decade, at least a more positive role. They've been active and mainly negative when they have done anything, in my opinion. But I don't have great hopes. I doubt that we're going to see any positive change simply because Israel is far stronger than it's been probably ever in its history vis-a-vis its neighbors and is much more of a position to resist any pressure because of the enormous sympathy for Israel as a result of this its perceived vulnerability due to these the attacks on it by Iraq. So we're in the paradoxical situation where Israel is stronger than ever before and is perceived as weak, and where there are many reasons for the United States to try and move Israel and probably more Israeli capabilities to resist being moved due to the sympathy for Israel. So I don't expect much myself.
There are many Palestinians living in Kuwait, working there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what effect you think the end of the war is going to have on Palestinians in Kuwait. Now, putting this in perspective, some Palestinians were accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. Others, it was said, worked with the resistance. Do you think that this is going to have any effect on Palestinians' future in Kuwait?
It may. There were reports before the war ended that the Kuwaiti government in exile had plans to imprison, in turn, all Palestinians, to screen them, to expel most, detain some, and allow some to remain. I don't know if those plans will be implemented or if, in fact, the report was accurate. Certainly, the Palestinian community in Kuwait, which was the most stable and prosperous of the post-1948 Palestinian diaspora communities, is going to be uprooted in its large majority, I would guess. And certainly the Palestinians are going to suffer there, as in the occupied territories, for their opinions. It will not be the acts of a few collaborators that will be punished on an individual basis. It will be the entire community of several hundred thousand people which will be punished for its beliefs and its opinions, as is happening in the occupied territories. I mean, 1.9 million people are in prison for 42 days because the Israelis don't like what they think, essentially, or what they are. And that's what's going to happen, I'm afraid, perhaps, to Palestinians in the Gulf. The fact that they were unsympathetic to the United States is going to be, in a sense, the reason that they will be punished.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Rashid Khalidi is the Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What will military historians be studying about the Gulf War decades from now? Coming up, we ask Sir Michael Howard, professor of military and naval history at Yale University. He's the author of such books as War and the Liberal Conscience and The Causes of War. And we end the week with some music. Our rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three new albums by three British bands. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A meeting tomorrow between Allied and Iraqi leaders in the Persian Gulf has been postponed. President Bush had said earlier today that the meeting to talk about an exchange of prisoners of war, along with other matters, would be held tomorrow. Now, according to U.S. officials, the meeting has been postponed for 24 hours at the request of the Iraqis. In other Gulf news, Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz told the Iraqi news agency that U.S. forces are acting in a manner contrary to a ceasefire, and he said all foreign forces should get out of Iraq now. A U.N. report released today said that after 6 weeks of Allied bombing, Iraq's water, sanitation, and health systems are nearly destroyed. The report said the country is at risk of diseases such as cholera and meningitis. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
A 7-person UN team traveled to Iraq during the war at the request of Baghdad officials. In a report released today, they painted a grim picture of post-war life in the country. The report said nearly a million Baghdad residents have no water and must drink untreated river water. With no electricity, pumps don't work, and raw sewage flows into the streets. In addition, the healthcare system has virtually collapsed. Critical medicine is in short supply, and there has been a 4-fold increase in acute respiratory and diarrheal diseases. The report said all these factors, coupled with the approach of warm weather, puts Iraq at a serious risk of epidemics. UN officials said today they would begin sending food, medicine, and chemicals for water treatment to the region as soon as possible. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
New York City officials have confirmed that they will host a ticker tape parade on Broadway for U.S. troops returning from the Persian Gulf. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
It will be the mother of all parades, according to City Council member Herbert Berman, who hopes those marching will include General Norman Schwarzkopf and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Colin Powell, a native of the South Bronx. Initially, Mayor David Dinkins was noncommittal about the parade, citing the estimated $1 million cost, with the city facing a major budget deficit. But the mayor's office has now confirmed the parade will take place, and officials are inviting private contributions. Former Congressman, now Staten Island Borough President Guy Molinari, says he's already received pledges totaling up to $150,000. The date is uncertain until the military makes plans to send troops home, but city officials promise a welcome that will top the ticker tape turnout for the hostages in Iran, astronaut John Glenn, and the World Series champion Mets and Yankees. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
An earthquake measuring 6 on the Richter scale hit much of Costa Rica today. So far, there have been no reports of injuries or serious damage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 28 points to close at 2,909.90 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Algeria, officials have denied that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is seeking asylum there. There have been published reports in France that the Iraqi president planned to resign and had been in touch with Algerian officials to see if he could move there. The reports had said that Algerian officials were seeking assurances from the coalition allies that Saddam would not be pursued once he was in exile. In Colombia, more than 2,000 guerrillas from the People's Liberation Army surrendered their arms today. The rebels ended 22 years of violent struggle to become a political movement. Leslie Werpsa has more from Bogota.
Members of the Socialist Party of Spain received machine guns, rifles, grenades, and ammunition from the People's Liberation Army, or EPL, rebels. The surrender took place in 7 peace camps in rural Colombia. For 6 months, each rebel will receive a $130 monthly stipend from the government to enter civilian life. The EPL is the second major guerrilla movement in Colombia to surrender arms. Last year, the populist M19 rebels gave up their guns and became an important political party. SCM-19 ranked second in votes during elections in December for a national constituent assembly. The government's having a harder time, however, convincing the larger FARC and ELN rebels to follow suit. They have waged a major campaign of violence since the year began, with almost daily attacks on military convoys, oil pipelines, public buses, and electrical pylons. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wurpsa in Bogota.
Drought-stricken California has been hit by rain and snow as a winter storm moved in. The National Weather Service says that storm warnings are also up in parts of Montana, where more than a foot of snow is expected in the mountains. In California, in spite of heavy downpours, officials have warned that water levels are still below normal, and it would take days of rain to wash away the effects of the state's five-year drought. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. At his briefing earlier this week, General Norman Schwarzkopf used words like classic and extraordinary to describe the coalition's military performance. We asked Sir Michael Howard to put this war in a historical context. Howard is a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. His many books include War and the Liberal Conscience and The Causes of War. He also translated into English the now classic 1831 book On War by the Prussian officer Karl von Clausewitz. I asked him if there had been any other modern war where the casualties had been so disproportionate, with losses so high on one side and so low on the other.
Well, it depends how far you're prepared to go back for modern, but that does come to my mind, the war which the British fought in the Sudan at the end of the 19th century against a very comparable figure, somebody called the Mahdi, who was a charismatic leader of an Islamic society who was trying to overthrow the Western rule which the British had imposed in Egypt. And there we simply slaughtered the Mahdi masses by the use of machine guns, very largely. And the casualties were equally disproportionate, and the circumstances not dissimilar.
Is there an aspect of the Gulf War that you think will be studied in the decades to come?
Well, obviously the military will continue to study it very carefully until there is another war for them to study, to see how weapons performed, what command structures were valid, how tactical and operational doctrine was effective. But because of the weakness of the opposition, we may, I'm afraid, draw rather false conclusions. So when we come up against a really worthwhile enemy, we'll think it's going to be very much easier than it actually is going to be.
I'd like to ask you about air power. As you've pointed out, we've been basically unopposed in a lot of these maneuvers. But what do you think are the new lessons from this war in the use of air power?
Well, I don't know whether there is anything very new, but the old ones were reinforced. And that is, the first thing you have got to do is to destroy the enemy's capacity to interfere with you, to gain what is called in old-fashioned terms command of the air. And what we did, in fact, was, well, it was overkill, because we not only made it impossible for him to retaliate during this particular battle, but we obviously degraded, if not entirely destroyed, his capacity to maintain any kind of air cover over his own country, let alone anybody else's, for months, if not years, to come. We in fact, treated Iraq as we had treated Germany in World War II, that simply destroyed it as an industrial complex with any kind of military capability.
Do you think that was an inappropriate way to treat Iraq?
I think that we were not taking any risks. The more risks we took, the heavier our casualties were going to be, and the longer the war would go on. If there was a fault, it was a fault very much on the right side. It was, I think, a deliberate decision on the part of General Powell and the Allied High Command that we were not going to do what the Americans had done in Vietnam, which was to go on putting in always just too little, as a result prolonging the war and having not only taking heavier casualties ourselves, but probably sort of causing heavier losses ultimately to the adversary.
General Schwarzkopf has said that he didn't want to give body counts. He didn't want to always be giving casualty figures of the other side. What do you think his reasons were for that?
Well, I think that, again, to go back to Vietnam, the American High Command got into its head that what they were really concerned to do was killing gooks, killing Vietnamese, and that the more of them they killed, the better they were winning. The only way in which they could show they were winning was by body counts. Well, by any standard, ethical or military, that is a pretty miserable way of deciding whether you are or are not winning. To sort of stand on a heap of corpses and say, look how great we are, is not exactly a civilized way of carrying on. And I think that that General Schwarzkopf was behaving like a thoroughly civilized man when he said that.
The last time we spoke, you said, and I think I have this accurate, that you didn't think the military should deceive the press, that they might need to withhold information, but when they gave information, it should be accurate.
Yes.
Yes. Now, General Schwarzkopf said in that big briefing that he gave a couple of days ago that deception was a key weapon in compensating for the Iraqis' numerical advantage in the ground war, and they really wanted to deceive the Iraqis into thinking there was going to be a big amphibious landing on Kuwait. And Schwarzkopf said, many of you recall the number of amphibious rehearsals we had that was written about extensively for many reasons. Now, that led a lot of us to think that, you know, the press was intentionally invited to these amphibious rehearsals so that they'd write about it and the articles would be part of the deception campaign. If that was so, what do you think of that?
Well, there were amphibious rehearsals and the press were invited to attend them. If the press then drew the conclusion that there was going to be an amphibious attack, that was their business. They cannot blame the military for that if they care to undertake that kind of speculation.
The last time we spoke, I quoted something from Clausewitz and asked you to respond to it. The quote was, the fact that a bloody slaughter is a horrifying act must make us take war more seriously, but not provide an excuse for gradually blunting our swords in the name of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, someone will come along with a sharp sword and hack off our arms.
Yes.
I want to ask you about the opposite now. This was, after all, a war in which the coalition forces had astonishingly low casualties. And I'm wondering if you're concerned about the opposite, that this low number of casualties will give us a false view of war.
Well, in the first place, you must remember that we didn't take many casualties, but we inflicted a very bloody slaughter indeed. And that at the present estimates, something between 50 and 100,000 Iraqi troops were killed. Now, if that isn't a bloody slaughter, God knows what is. So it's not simply a matter of being prepared to accept casualties. It's a matter of being prepared, if necessary, to inflict them. Secondly, we did not know until we went in whether or not we were going to have to take large casualties. And we took the risk that we would have to. Thank heavens they did not actually happen. They did not happen very largely because of the overwhelming firepower which we brought to bear, and especially air power, which really stunned, if they didn't actually kill and destroy the defenders, who were then in no position to resist us when we came in. So it was the risk of taking them, those casualties, however, was something which weighed very heavily indeed upon our commanders. They quite rightly, from our point of view, determined that they would minimize casualties to our side by maximizing those to the other. And that, I'm afraid, is what does happen in war. And in future, we will obviously always do the same. We will do the best that we can to spare our own people suffering. But it can only come about through inflicting very, very hardships on those who are rash enough to fight us. Then whether we will be more willing to go to war in the future, I think that our morale, and especially if I may say so, that of the United States will be that much higher. It is a little like the British after the Falkland Islands. It was a shot in the arm to know that we can produce armies which can produce that kind of success. Whether or not it will make us more militaristic and gung-ho is an open question. I honestly don't think it will. when one recalls the enormous problems which there were in this country about gearing ourselves up for war or gearing yourselves up for war, when one remembers the problems and the sadness and the tension of the separation of families, this will not be forgotten, I think. What I hope will be remembered is that when military expeditions have to be mounted, it can be done, and if they're well commanded, it'll be successful. But I think it will also be remembered that it does require an enormous amount of wrenching effort to do it.
Sir Michael Howard is a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. Coming up, the mother of a soldier who isn't allowing herself to feel relieved just yet. This is Fresh Air. Americans are sharing a sense of relief that the fighting has stopped and our casualties have been remarkably low. But some Americans who haven't yet heard from family members in the Gulf are still worrying. Louise Hall's son is a sergeant in an Army combat supply unit. We called her at her home in Northern Virginia and asked how she felt when she heard about the ceasefire.
I think we'd had so many ups and downs as far as the end to this war that it was very difficult at first to immediately respond that the war is over. It is still taking time to digest the fact that the war is over for the most part.
You mean like you almost won't allow yourself to believe it just in case it isn't true?
Absolutely not. I will not believe everything is over until my child comes home, until my son returns.
There were so remarkably few casualties on the coalition side, that must give you a lot of reason.
Well, I look at it this way. What is minimum casualty to the person who lost someone, that's maximum casualty. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The mother or the wife or the child who lost a father or a husband or son, that's maximum loss.
Are you very grateful to how the coalition military handled the war and ended it with so few casualties on the coalition side?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would dread the thought that we would have lost any more than we did. But I see mankind as one big, enormous thing. And the people on the other side who lost, they are also human beings. President Bush keeps telling us that our fight is not against the Iraqi people. What Saddam Hussein did in Kuwait was certainly something that we all abhorred and something that should not have happened. And so I see those people and their suffering. There was an awful lot of suffering that occurred for the United States. Fortunately, they keep telling us that the casualties were minimal. Of course, that makes me happy. But at the same time, I cannot forget the rest of this chain of people, of human beings.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
I'd like to just hope that mankind can learn to settle differences without having to go to war, and that there are a lot of people who are suffering in many, many ways, and if we can use the energy that we used in the war, use it toward education and the homeless and the elderly and some of the medical needs that are required in our country and other countries, that I think that I would feel proud to be a part of the human race. I think there's much that we can do to help people. And I hope that what comes of this war will not be bitterness and hatred, that we can drop the bitter and hatred feelings and move along to, you know, create a better atmosphere.
Well, I thank you for talking with us, and I hope you hear from your son very soon.
All right.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye
now.
Louise Hall spoke to us from her home in Northern Virginia. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have?
Well, we have the news on the situation in Kuwait City now, and also accounts from the Pentagon of how the U.S. Actually did fight, how U.S. forces performed in the war against Iraq. We'll be hearing what President Bush has to say. And we'll also be talking to the spokesman for the president of Turkey and a leader of the, or spokesman rather, for a Kurdish nationalist movement out of Iraq, and hear what their ideas are for a post-war Iraq. It may not be the description of the same strong, centralized Iraqi nation that we've known over the past several decades, but rather a more decentralized federation where Kurds might have some autonomy.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We haven't heard lately from our rock critic Ken Tucker because of our special Gulf War programming, but Ken's back with a review of three British bands popular here now on college radio stations and MTV.
To an American rock fan, England can seem like the bizarro world in the old Superman comics, a land in which everything is the opposite of what we do. When we were listening to Motown and Fabian, they had the Beatles. When we started idolizing Bruce Springsteen, they thought the Clash was God. These days, American rock is obsessed with social issues and places a great emphasis on the authenticity of the artist. This was epitomized by the recent Milli Vanilli scandal. England, by contrast, is obsessed with artifice and cleverness, with bright passing fads that strive to be as inauthentic as possible. To look at their record charts or read their music magazines, you'd think there was a new major pop movement every 3 weeks or so. The new sound is typified by a group of sullen Manchester bands like In Spiral Carpets.
Husband don't know what he's done. Kids don't know what's wrong with mom. She can't say, they can't see. Putting it down to another bad day. Daddy don't know what he's done. Kids don't know what's wrong with mom. So this is how it feels to be lonely. This is how it feels to be small. This is how it feels when your world means nothing at all.
Making attractive music out of feelings of alienation and hopelessness, that's the strategy of In Spiral Carpets. Like many bands from working-class backgrounds outside of London, they convey the dreary misery of Thatcherism and offer an escape from it. Escapism of an even giddier sort is offered by another group, Happy Mondays, whose recent album, Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches, has been hailed the Sgt. Pepper of a new psychedelic movement.
It's a sack on me. Can't stand to leave. Get around here. You ask who you feed. Yippee, yippee, yay, 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 yay. I had to crucify somebody.
That's Happy Mondays and Kinky Afro, which rips off big chunks of LaBelle's 1970s pop hit Lady Marmalade and parades its own cynicism. Elsewhere, the group sings the praises of Donovan, whose Sunshine Superman and Mellow Yellow are the sort of campy, druggy pop that they aspire to make themselves. Like a lot of English pop just now, Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches suggest that the best alternative to a life in an England depressed in every sense is to go for immediate gratification, whether it's popping pills for instant thrills or the quick, cheap laugh of praising Donovan. Of all the English bands trying to wring pleasure from despair, the most striking is Lush, a group that swaddles its discontent in thick layers of guitars and the cushiony voice of lead singer Mickey Beregni. A song like that one, called Deluxe, gives the music of Lush a rush. Its surging melody rises up and pulls you into its rhythms. In Spiral Carpets and Happy Mondays want to hold you at arm's length from their songs, as if they're above their audience and in any case don't quite trust them. Lush, on the other hand, wants to make its chilliness irresistible. The band has a song called Sweetness and Light, whose title is intended sarcastically. They have others called Downer and Leaves Me Cold, which aren't sarcastic at all. The artistic paradox of this music is that the group brings a fervent passion to the portrayal of coldness. Call me an American, but it's the passion that I admire.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, you're free at last. I'll be beginning to forget the past. Does it make you sad when you think about your life?
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Dan Loughran, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
More than one out of every 10 members of the military is a woman. On the next Fresh Air, we look at how the war in the Gulf redefined the role of women in the military with Carolyn Beecraft of the Women and the Military Project. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.